For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
So I entitled this Fighting for Friendship, and the part that I want to really focus on is sort of the practical aspects of building a friendship. Now, the theme of this is that I'm sort of looking at friendship from the lens of the book of Proverbs. What does the book of Proverbs say about friendship? When you study the book of Proverbs, you'll notice that sometimes it'll say, you know, that we should treat our neighbor a certain way. That word in Hebrew has sort of a wide range of meaning. It can mean either a neighbor, somebody that you live in close proximity to, but it can also refer to a very close friend. And in most cases, we see that the author of Proverbs uses it in reference to the friendships that we're building. Now, I think it's important for us to sort of think about the state of friendships in America today. As Jim Leffel mentioned in the first session on Wednesday night, people in America are feeling increasingly isolated. To build on some of the research he pointed to there, sociologist and Duke University professor Lynn Smith Lovin, great name, says that nearly 50% of Americans report they discuss important matters with either one person or no one at all. That's a pretty staggering number right there. 50%. One in two Americans report that they only have one person that they feel comfortable discussing important matters with, and that includes their spouse or family member. And so I think that many Americans today feel very isolated. They feel very lonely. Secondly, the number of people who report they have no close friends has tripled in recent decades. So there is a trend toward isolation where people feel increasingly alone. In the 1980s, 33% of Americans claimed to have a network of 4 to 5 people with whom they could talk about important matters. And today, that number has dropped by 50% down to 15% of Americans. And so we're living in an age where people feel lonely. And I think Smith Lovin tries to point to several factors as the reasons for this. She thinks that it's probably because of longer commutes to work, longer hours at the office, and media consumption that might be part of the reason why people feel increasingly isolated. I think that's probably true to some extent. Now, I think most of us who are sitting here feel like building friendships is important. You probably wouldn't be here if you didn't think that. But I think it's important for us to build a theological foundation for friendship so that when we encounter difficult times where our lives get busy and that we find less and less time for our friends, we can go back to the biblical principles driving our need for friendship. First of all, we need to recognize that God built the need for companionship into our architecture. Think about Genesis chapter 2, verse 18. When God created the first man, he noticed that even though man was unified with God and there was perfect harmony between them, he still noticed that there was something missing. And he said it wasn't good for man to be alone. And so he created the woman, his counterpart. And so, likewise, God has built into our architecture this desire, this yearning for a relationship. And we see this actually have some physiological ramifications as well. In a recent 2015 study from BYU, it shows that the subjective feelings of loneliness increase the risk of death by 26% among people 65 years and older. On a physiological level, it seems like what God says is true, that we need relationships. That it's not just a subjective thing, but there's something about the way we are as human beings that requires closeness and friendship. Also, we can't faithfully follow Christ if we don't build deep Christian friendships. You'll hear sometimes Christians say, yeah, you know, me and God, we're real close, but I'm not really a people person. I have a really hard time with people. Well, according to the Bible, you can't really make that kind of neat division. That if you are close to God, or at least if you claim to be close to God, then you also have to love people. Those two things are interconnected with one another. I think you can read the Bible all day long. You can pray as much as you want, but you're never going to really see significant spiritual growth unless you're vitally connected in Christian fellowship. To illustrate this, I remember a friend telling this story, or it was an analogy. He said, you know, imagine if you were a coach and you were recruiting a basketball player for your team. So you just happen to go to a local park and you see this guy who's, you know, a physical freak. He's like 6'7". He's like 250 pounds of pure muscle. And, you know, his friend who keeps passing him a ball, you know, he's just lighting up three-pointers, never misses. During a pickup game, you know, somebody alley-oops a ball to him and he goes above the rim and just nearly breaks the backboard as he dunks. And so afterwards, you go up to him and you're like, hey, you know, I want to recruit you to be a part of our basketball team. And he's like, yeah, that's fine. I'll play for you guys. And so, you know, you're sort of licking your lips to show, you know, your secret weapon at your first game. And so your first game comes along and you decide to call him in. You're like, okay, I want you to play a few minutes here. And he said, you know, there's one thing you need to know, coach. And you're like, what's that? And he's like, I don't really know how to dribble. And you're like, okay, well, you don't have to dribble that much, just, you know, enough to be able to, you know, drive in and dunk, right? He's like, no, you don't understand. I don't know how to dribble at all. I mean, what good would a basketball player be if they didn't know how to dribble, right? I mean, their whole game would fall apart. And so likewise, we can't view it as, well, you know, if I engage in prayer, if I engage in regular Bible study, then maybe I'll grow at like a 66% rate. It doesn't work that way. We need everything. We need to be involved in fellowship in order to live out the things that we're learning in the Bible. And also, when we're spending time with other believers, it gives us things to actually pray about. And so all of these things are interconnected with one another. Obviously, being connected with people in your body of Christ, your local body of Christ, is really important. Thirdly, and Dennis talked about this extensively last night, so I don't want to spend a lot of time about this, but there are, according to some scholars, nearly 60 one another passages. And of course, there's a lot of overlap between them. But these one another passages imply spending lots of time with close spiritual friends. For example, you think about Galatians chapter 6, where Paul says that we should bear one another's burdens. And it raises the question, how can you bear someone's burden if you don't really spend a lot of time with them to understand what they're burdened about? That implies that you're spending regular time with that person. And it's very hard to think that you're going to be able to dig in deep enough with somebody when you only see them once a week on Sunday morning for, you know, maybe an hour or two. And so when you look at the whole picture of the one another passages, it implies that we are spending regular time with one another. And according to the passages that Dennis showed last night, probably spending multiple nights a week or several times a week with other believers, digging into their lives, relating to them, and thinking about them when we're not with them. You know, I was spending some time with a non-Christian guy a number of years ago that I was reaching out to, and, you know, I think we spent maybe, we hung out maybe once a month. We'd go out on a bike ride or get lunch occasionally. And I remember one time we were getting lunch and he was, you know, spilling his guts about some pretty serious stuff in his life. And he was just like, you know, I didn't know who else to turn to because you're like my closest friend. And I felt honored by that. I was like, you know, I'm glad that he feels that way, but it just made me realize that in the world, people's standards are so low for what close friendship is. Some people regard somebody that they see once a year as their best friend. And yet, when we look at the body of Christ, I mean, what we're talking about, the level of closeness that we're supposed to enjoy is so much greater than what people in the world should be having. Okay, let's turn to some modern challenges that we face in friendship. You know, when you think about the last 2 decades, information technology has really redefined and changed the way that we interact in our relationships. You know, for example, internet connectivity gives us the ability to stay connected with friends who live thousands of miles away. So, for example, if your friend Elena decides that she's going to up and move to Paraguay for 2 months, you know, you can stay in contact with her almost in real time. 100 years ago, you had to send her a letter and wait a couple weeks to find out how she would respond. But through FaceTime and Skype, you know, you can watch her react to things that you say and even watch her laugh at some of your jokes if you're funny. And so it's incredible how technology has allowed us to be able to stay connected with our friends. You know, fresh research suggests that mobile phones, social media, and network video games play a vital role in how people meet and interact with friends. This is especially true among young people. According to a Pew Research Center poll, text message plays a key role in day-to-day interaction among teens. According to that study, 86% of teens believe that text messaging with their friends is one way that they remain connected with them. 55% spend time every single day text messaging their friends. For boys, video games plays a crucial role in development and maintenance of their friendship. And of course, we're not just talking about, you know, sitting in the same room and playing Xbox. We're talking about network games. The majority of boys, 78%, feel like online gaming actually strengthens their friendship. So they feel like video games are sort of a way for them to relate to their friends and to maintain their friendships on a pretty deep level, according to them. And more than half of teens report meeting at least one friend online. So it's not only a way to maintain friendships, it's also an avenue to meet new people. Of the teens who met a friend online, 57% of boys met a friend playing network video games. I was talking to a guy in my home church who was telling me that he was going to drive all the way to Kansas City to go hang out with his friend. I was like, oh, is he like your close family friend or something like that? And he's like, no, I met him playing League of Legends. I'm like, so have you ever met him before? He's like, yeah, through the video game. And, you know, I was just like, maybe I'm old. I don't understand things like that. But, you know, that's very common, I guess. The question, though, I think we need to ask ourselves is, does the increased volume of interaction actually lead to authentic relating? In other words, does the higher level of connectivity equate to more depth in our relationships? Many teens feel like people on social media are less authentic than they are in person. 3/4 of teens said that people are less real on social media than they are offline, and nearly half of teens face pressure to curate flattering or popular content. Oh yeah. You know, the genius of social media is that you can curate the content that you put out there about yourself. And I think many of us have had this kind of experience where, you know, you're sort of going through someone's profile on Facebook or reading, you know, their Twitter profile. You're just like, man, this person is like the funnest, coolest, happiest person ever. You know, because in practically every picture you see of them, they're smiling or jumping in the air, hanging out with friends, smiling. And then you meet them in person and they're like the dullest, boringest person you've ever met. And you know, that's the thing that's appealing, I think, about social media is that we can present a self that we really want to put out there to people that may not be like the real person, but at the very least puts out an image that we want. Sherry Turkle, an expert on how information technology is impacting the way that we relate. She's a professor of social studies and technology at MIT, says, when I ask people, what's wrong with having a conversation? People say, I'll tell you what's wrong with having a conversation. It takes place in real time. And you can't control what you're going to say. So that's the bottom line. Texting, emailing, posting, all of these things let us present the self that we want to be. We get to edit. And that also means that we get to delete. That means we get to retouch the face, the voice, the flesh, the body. Not too little, not too much, just right. And so the appeal of social media and interacting in that way is that it gives us control over how we present ourselves to people. Now, you might be asking yourself, that seems a little bit critical. I mean, is it really that bad? Or to use the words of Stephen Colbert, do all those little tweets, do all those little sips of online communication add up to really one big gulp of real conversation? Well, I think, again, Turkle is a little bit critical of primarily interacting through social media and text message. She says, online we easily find company, but we're exhausted by the pressures of performance. We enjoy continual connection, but rarely have each other's full attention. We can have instant audiences, but then flatten out what we say to each other. The ties that we form through the internet are not, in the end, ties that bind. In other words, even though we may connect with people through social media and through IT, that doesn't necessarily mean that those kind of relationships will have the enduring power that we want. She goes on, human relationships are rich, they're messy, they're demanding, and we clean them up with technology. And when we do, one of the things that can happen is that we sacrifice conversation for mere connection. And I think I think she's right on with this distinction, that there's a difference between connecting and actually having a conversation. Because connecting is easy in the sense that you can send out sound bites to people. But in conversation, it requires relational skill. You know, some research even suggests that cell phones and tablets may impair our ability to relate and empathize with people. In 2014, Yalda Uhls, a researcher at Harvard, conducted a field experiment where she selected 50 children and had them go to an outdoor camp for 5 days. What she was trying to study was whether or not face-to-face interaction improved people's ability to empathize. And the catch was this. They could spend 5 days at this camp, but they had to leave their tablets, their phones, and their devices at home. And so at the end of the 5 days, she had all 50 children look at videos and look at pictures where actors and actresses were demonstrating some sort of feeling state, and they had to accurately identify what this person was feeling. Then they compared it with a control study that wasn't there, and they found that the students who were at the outdoor camp did significantly better than those who weren't there, the control group. And so the question is, what happened? Well, what happened was when you're relating face-to-face with people, you're picking up on nuances. You're picking up on social cues that you otherwise wouldn't be able to get through text message. And so there's a skill in relating that we need to be able to develop that merely connecting through IT will never be able to give us. You know, a recent Pew Research Center poll shows that 82% of adults said that people who use their cell phones in social settings hurt conversation. So merely the presence of your phone can actually disrupt conversation. And I felt that before. You know, you're sitting there talking to someone and they pull out their phone. It's almost like, so you don't care about what I'm saying then. Well, nearly all of those same respondents, 89% of them, also admitted to pulling out their cell phone at a recent gathering. And so even though we have an intuitive sense that pulling out our device can disrupt the flow of conversation, there is this compulsion, this impulse to pull out our phone. Turkle says, We get used to a new way of being alone together. People want to be with each other, but also somewhere else. Connected to all the different places we want to be. People want to customize their lives. They want to go in and out of all the places they are because the thing that matters most to them is control over where they put their attention. And I think that's maybe the reason why devices are so appealing. Because it puts control squarely into our hands. Where if I'm done with this conversation or if I'm done talking to you, I could put my attention elsewhere and talk to somebody else. She says, these days, those phones in our pockets are changing our minds and our hearts because they offer us three gratifying fantasies. One, that we can put our attention wherever we want. Two, that we'll always be heard. And three, that we never have to be alone. The moment that people are alone, even for a few seconds, they become anxious. They panic, they fidget, they reach for a device. Just think of people at a checkout line or at a red light. Being alone feels like a problem that needs to be solved. You know, our ability to be alone without notifications and alerts constantly going off actually aids reflection. And reflection furnishes us with important insight. Insight that will supply substance to our conversations. And that's important because it's impossible to really build a deep relationship by simply exchanging useless facts or sound bites. We need to have authentic relating. Digital communication works better, I think, for maintaining certain types of relationships. Now, let's not just throw out blanket statements about IT here. Because, you know, especially, older generations, no matter what generation you're in, older generations are always going to say, you know, that new technology, that's bad. That's going to destroy our society. It's from the devil, you know. And our society has gone on, and it's been okay. And so I think that we need to have a balanced view here. Younger people use IT for different reasons than older people do. Your grandma, who's 70 years old, who's on Facebook, is using Facebook for different reasons than, you know, their teenage granddaughter or grandson. In fact, the reason that their teenage grandson and granddaughter aren't on Facebook is because grandma's on there liking their stuff all the time. And so they've decided to move on to different platforms. But I think digital communication is helpful in maintaining long-term friendships that we've had a long time ago. This is Julie Beck from The Atlantic. She wrote an article on, digital communication and how that relates to relationships. She says, saying happy birthday on Facebook, faving a friend's tweet, these are all life support machines of friendship. They keep it breathing, but mechanically. Social media makes it possible to maintain more friendships, but more shallowly. And it can also keep relationships on life support that would and maybe should otherwise have died out. Facebook makes things weird by keeping friends continually in your peripheral vision. It violates what you might call the camp friend rule of commemorative relationships. No matter how close you were with your best friend from summer camp, it's always awkward to try to stay in touch when school starts again. Because your camp self and your school self are different. And it dilutes the magic of the memory a little to try to attempt a pale imitation of what you had. The same goes for friends you only see online. If you never see your friends in person, you're not really sharing experiences so much as keeping each other updated on your separate lives. It becomes a relationship based on storytelling rather than shared living. It's not bad, it's just not the same. And I agree with her. Social media has its part, but it's never going to be an adequate substitute for real, deep relationships. You can't accomplish that simply texting and using social media. It's going to require real face-to-face interaction. So I guess to maybe summarize our thinking on this, we need to Think about IT as a tool that actually accentuates our relationships. You know, when I think about my wife, and as I'm driving here, for instance, she texts me and says, "Hey, you know, I'm praying for you. I hope you do a good job on your talk." I feel encouraged by that. I'm glad that she sent me that text message. But I know that later on I'm going to go home and we're going to interact face to face. And so IT is supplementary. It can never be a substitute for real authentic relating. Now, as it turns out, real relating requires some skill. It's not that easy. It's not like you just wake up one day and turn out to be an awesome relator. And so the Proverbs, I think, offers us some qualities of what a good friend should look like. And I want to go through some of these. The first is that a good friend is consistent. You know, there are a lot of fair-weather friends out there. Think about Proverbs 19, verse 4. Wealth makes many friends, but poverty drives them all away. You know, you think about the person who hobnobs with the rich, and their hope is that through associating with the rich, it's going to open up some opportunities and bring them wealth and maybe some power. But as soon as that person's wealth dries up, they vanish like dew on a sunny morning. And so there are tons of fair weather friends out there. You know, this proverb actually makes me think of this guy right here, MC Hammer from the 90s. Believe it or not, this dude was really cool. He popularized the parachute pants. I think I have a pair still in my closet. I use it occasionally for camping as a tarp. One day, though, it's going to come back into style. I think we're like in the 80s right now, where 80s style is coming back, so I'm waiting for the 90s to come back, and I'm just going to bust out my entire wardrobe and be the coolest guy you know. So MC Hammer, you know, was this superstar musician, and he made $33 million off of this single, "You Can't Touch This." You know, even by our standards today, 25 years later, $33 million off a single is an enormous amount of money. And he describes how during that time, he had this incredible mansion, and that 24 hours a day, people he didn't even know were hanging out at his house, in and out, and just spending all this time with him. They acted like they were his best friend, but 6 years later, he filed for bankruptcy. And he said at that point, hardly anybody was his friend. And so, you know, we encounter many fair weather friends. In fact, some of us, if we're honest with ourselves, might view ourselves as a fair weather friend. That we're loyal to people so long as there's an advantage for us, or so long as it's convenient for us. What about Proverbs 18:24? "There's a friend who destroys each other, but a real friend sticks closer than a brother." I know that I experienced this the first year that I started walking with God. I immersed myself in Christian fellowship, and I came from a really dysfunctional family. And when I started hanging out with my Christian friends, the love that I felt from them made me feel like they were my real family. And so it's possible for us to have the kind of closeness with our Christian friends that mirrors that of even our relatives or our siblings. Proverbs 27 verse 10, "Never abandon a friend, either yours or your father's." So we shouldn't just focus on what kind of friends we should keep. We should also think about how we could be the kind of friend that others would want. You know, you hear sermons on friendship, and a lot of times it's focused on you need to find a good friend who's going to treat you the right way. Well, what about you? We need to think about whether we are the type of friend that serves and loves people. Whether we are the type of friend who gives of his or herself selflessly. I think also today in our society, I think people have grown increasingly cynical about friendship. I remember before I was walking with God, you know, I would notice that each of my relationships with my friends would just end after about a year. It's almost like somebody came up and just slapped a 1-year expiration date on all of my friendships. And by the end of it, I started to feel like, you know, I just don't know if I could ever maintain a real good friendship with people. And yet everything changed the moment I received Christ. Because there was a basis to forgive. A lot of times my relationships ended because we would have friction in our relationship. And there was just really no way to move forward. There was no way to forgive one another. And yet, when it comes to what Christ has done for us, that gives us a unique basis, almost an obligation to forgive one another. Not to mention, the unity that we experience through Christ is incredible. Notice what Paul says in Ephesians 4:3. He says, make sure that you maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. He doesn't say that we should attain unity. He says we should maintain unity with each other. In other words, when we come to Christ, the Holy Spirit enters into our lives, and the Spirit actually places us into the body of Christ so that we are mystically united with one another. And so, even though our interests might be different, even though we may not have a lot in common with people that we are surrounded with in Christian fellowship, we have a basis to actually be close to one another. And, today I can boast that God has given me some awesome friendships that have lasted a long time. And it's interesting, it seems like the closeness that I have with Christ roughly mirrors the closeness that I have with my friends. You know, there's a guy that I actually have been hanging out with every single week since I've been walking with God for over 17 years. And, that's not because I'm a good person or because I try really hard, but it's because of what God has done in me. And it's awesome. Secondly, we see that good friends speak honestly. Think about Proverbs 27, verse 6. Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but deceitful are the kisses of an enemy. Oh yeah, flattery doesn't help anybody. Good friends speak truth to one another, even when it hurts sometimes. You know, think about Ephesians 4 again, where Paul says that we should speak the truth in love to one another. That when we speak God's word to people, our friends, and it's draped in love, that it can have an incredible impact on the people around us. And, you know, we have to remember that it may not land initially. I mean, people get very defensive. People get angry whenever you confront them with something that they're in the wrong about. But over time, I think, as they listen to the Holy Spirit, if they're willing to take input, they're going to be grateful that we gave them that input. Think about Proverbs 28, verse 23. He who rebukes a man will in the end gain more favor than he who has a flattering tongue. Notice he says, he who rebukes a man will in the end. Not right away, but after some time. And I have to say that I've been in that position where somebody has confronted me. They had enough courage to say something about a problem in my life, and I was offended. I was mad. And then later on, I started thinking about it and praying about it, and I realized, you know, he's right. And there was this feeling of just love, and this sense that God was actually speaking to me through this person. And eventually I went back to him and I was just like, you know, thank you so much for saying that. I feel like God spoke through you. And so good friends speak God's truth to one another. You know, people in our culture are hesitant to speak truth to one another. We live in a largely morally relativistic culture. And so the idea that you know what's right or wrong for someone else seems really arrogant. Not to mention, we live in a highly individualistic culture where self-reliance is a key value. And so to think that we need to rely on our friends to give us advice or to speak truth into our lives is really offensive. You know, as followers of Christ, we need to look to the Scripture to inform us about what's right and wrong. That becomes the real basis for speaking truth. Not that I know what's best for you because I'm smart enough or because I've thought about it enough. It's because I know what God says is true. And so I'm not speaking for myself. I'm speaking what God says. Also, this includes encouraging our friend to see the truth when they're struggling. So it's not just about correcting errors. It's also about helping push them forward. Sometimes we're going to encounter Christian friends who are undergoing incredible trials and suffering. And we need to be there for them to push them along, to urge them to keep fighting for their relationship with Christ and not to give up. Thirdly, good friends give wise counsel. Think about Proverbs 27, verse 9. Perfume and incense bring joy to the heart, and the pleasantness of one's friend springs from his earnest counsel. Many of us have experienced feeling confused about the direction of our lives. We don't know what God wants us to do next. And as we think about it and pray about it, there's no clear direction. So we decide, you know, I'm just going to go in this direction here. And God will actually send people into our lives to sort of redirect us when He knows that that's not the trajectory He wants us to move along. I've had that so many different times, especially in ministry, where I'm confused about how to help my friend. And so I go into a conversation with a game plan, but then the Holy Spirit or somebody will come and talk to me and say, you know, I wonder if this maybe is a better direction to go here. And I take that as from God, that He's actually redirecting my path. You know, God can also use a healthy clash of personalities to hone our perspective. Think about Proverbs 27, verse 17. As iron sharpens iron, so a friend sharpens a friend. And so it's a good thing when friends collide at times, when personalities clash, where we have a difference of opinion and we're having healthy dialogue and debate, because we can sharpen our each other's perspective. Also, good friends have relational awareness. In other words, they can pick up on how their friends are feeling or what's the appropriate thing to do in certain situations around our friend. Think about Proverbs 25, verse 17. Don't set foot too frequently into your friend's house, lest he become weary of you and hate you. Oh yeah. Good friends know how to give their friends space. They're not clingy. They don't impose themselves upon their friends. That's a quality that we need to learn, is relational awareness. You know, some of our habits that we've picked up that are somewhat antisocial are minor irritants to our friends. You know, I think about my time that I spent living in a ministry house, and I encountered a lot of people during the 8 or 9 years that I was living in a ministry house. And I think that throughout the entire time I was living in the house, there were at least 10 guys living there at one time. And of course, everybody had their little weird tics and quirks. I remember one of my roommates was a real cheapskate. And so he would go to Sam's Club once a month, and he would buy a month's worth of frozen pizzas, the dollar ones. And he would go to our two refrigerators that we had in our house, and he would literally shove them packed full of the freezer, so that if you even opened the door, you know, just the pizzas would start spilling out of the freezer. And so each time he would do this, nobody could use the freezer because it was full of pizzas. And so it was really frustrating because we had to wait like a week until he started eating his pizzas before we could actually use the freezer. Or another friend of mine, you know, we would be real late to class or something like that, and waiting to go to the bathroom, brush our teeth or something like that. And this guy, he would take 20 or 30 minutes in the bathroom, which, you know, for the men folk, that's unusual. The ladies are like, what's wrong with that? But, you know, there were weird sounds emanating from the bathroom and stuff, and we're just like, what is going on with this guy? And so finally we confronted him. We're like, dude, why do you take so long in the bathroom? And he's like, oh, nothing. And we're like, no, just tell us. You know, we have to wait for you every single morning to get ready or whatever. And finally he broke down. He's like, you know, it's kind of embarrassing. I got this weird thing that I developed when I was younger, that anytime I go to the bathroom, I have to take off all of my clothes turn on the shower and the faucet, and that's the only way that I can go to the bathroom. And we're like, dude, you need some counseling. I mean, you know, you look at those things and it's just like, they're minor irritants. They don't really bother anybody, you know, in the grand scheme of things. But, oh, here's a good proverb on this. Proverbs 27 verse 14, a loud and cheerful greeting early in the morning will be taken as a curse. Oh yeah, you know, you're just sitting there in bed and stuff, and you got one of your roommates who's a morning person, and they come bounding in your room with a big smile on their face with, you know, they've already drank two pots of coffee, and they're like, hey, how's it going? You know, and they're jumping on top of you, and you just want to punch them in the face. Like, get away from me right now. I've got a taser in my hand, and I'm going to use it on you. You know, although some of our habits possess a certain charm, others make it almost unbearable to be around. You know, you think about people who have relational tics that make it really hard to relate to them. I thought, you know, about a guy who, as we would be sitting there talking, he would literally correct our grammar and pronunciation in real time. And, you know, I think he was oblivious to it. I don't think he knew what that was doing or how it was disrupting conversation. And so sometimes we need to help each other out and speak truth to each other and reflect back to people how their behavior can be somewhat antisocial. You know, we need to have enough courage to do that for our friends because they probably don't even know. You know, we tell our friends, you know, I know that you're joking and you're being really sarcastic, but a lot of times when you do that sort of stuff, it makes people think that you're really just cynical and negative. Okay, I think people need to hear that sometimes. Others possess the kind of insensitivity that you might categorize as being downright cruel. Proverbs 25 verse 20, like one who takes away a garment on a cold day or like vinegar poured on a wound. I've never had that happen to me before. It sounds bad. Is one who sings songs to a heavy heart. And so, as a good friend knows how to pick up on relational cues, they know how to comfort people. Think about the classic person who, you know, stumbles into a situation with a friend who's hurting and starts, you know, laying out all of these platitudes about how, you know, God will just, you know, he'll make everything all right. You just need to trust him. That's not what that person often needs in that moment. They need somebody to just sit there with them and to mourn with them. And so good friends know what is the appropriate thing to do in a specific situation. Also, good friends are few and close. The fact is, we can't have, you know, 100 close friends. I remember talking to someone and, you know, we were walking down the street and, you know, he must have pointed out 3 of his best friends that he knew. And I was thinking to myself, wait, isn't a best friend by definition only one person? How can you have like 10 best friends? They wouldn't be best friends. They'd be better friends or good friends, right? And so, if we want to have real deep friendships, we need to focus on a few. Think about Proverbs 18, verse 24. A man of many companions may come to ruin, but there's a friend who sticks closer than a brother. You know, if we want to have deep relationships, we need to set up roots that go down. And we need to have that common experience over years. We need to dig in deep with people. Relate on a deep level. You know, some of us sadly probably have relationships that could be categorized as, you know, a mile wide but an inch deep. You know, we've got lots of friends, but we still feel lonely. And that's probably because there's not enough depth to our relationships. You know, I was thinking about before I met Christ again, and I think a lot of my relationships were very superficial. A number of years ago, I was hanging out with an old friend that I used to spend time with almost every single day while I was in high school. And, you know, over a drink, we were just joking around and laughing about old times. And as the night started to wind down, you know, we started talking about more serious things. And it occurred to me that when I first met this guy, you know, his mom lost her battle with cancer. And I heard about it from one of my other friends. And yet, for some reason, I never even talked to him about it. I never even asked him about it. And in the moment, I felt, you know, the Spirit sort of nudging me, telling me to bring it up. And finally, you know, I said, you know, hey, man, remember when we first started hanging out? You know, I heard about your mom and what happened to her. And I realized I never asked you about that. And I just wanted to let you know, I'm sorry. I don't know why I never did that. Maybe I was just too immature. I felt like it was too awkward. But I just wanted to let you know that, you know, I wish I was a better friend to you. And of course, you know, he sort of shrugged it off. He said, you know, dude, don't worry about it. That was a long time ago. And I'm really glad, though, that God has transformed my relationships today, where I feel like people can ask me about serious things in my life, that people can bring serious things to me and feel like they can trust me. And hopefully you enjoy those kind of relationships too. And if not, I would urge you, challenge you to push for real depth in your relationships. Also, good friends don't influence you to sin. Oh yeah, Proverbs 12, verse 26. The righteous choose their friends carefully, but the way of the wicked leads them astray. I think we're more susceptible to people's influence than we would like to give credit. You know, this is especially true if you are intent on sharing your faith with people. It's really easy to spend a lot of time with non-Christian people. And you got to be really careful, though, because sometimes you get to a place where maybe your non-Christian friend is actually influencing you more than you are influencing them towards spiritual things. This is never more true than it when it comes to high school students. I know people who have had good intentions to reach out to their friends who are, you know, pot smokers or into a certain scene. And they want to look and act like them in superficial ways, but also reach out to them. But eventually they end up sort of co-opting the sins of their friends. We need to be careful. You know, this also works in the opposite direction too. Think about Proverbs 22, verse 24 through 25. Don't befriend angry people or associate with hot-tempered people, or you will learn to be like them and endanger your soul. Where, you know, on the one hand, we can co-opt new sins, but at the same time, if we hang out with people who are spiritually minded, they can actually push us in a positive direction towards spiritual things. That's why, you know, working with younger students, you know, one of the things that I really try to emphasize with guys that I'm working with, young guys, is that they need to link arms with somebody that they regard as a peer friend. Because, you know, especially in high school and in college, it gets really tough to fight off temptation. And often what you need is somebody who is right where you're at, a peer, same life situation, fighting the same fight as you are, and able to give you the kind of encouragement that will push you forward during difficult times. Now, I wanted to sort of leave or end our time here by sort of painting a positive vision for friendship from an example that I think is one of the greatest pictures of friendship in the Bible. It comes from the Old Testament, the friendship that David and Jonathan had. It's kind of interesting when David and Jonathan met, David walked into Saul's court right after defeating Goliath, and he's, you know, is holding Goliath's severed head in his hand. And that's when he met Jonathan. And at that moment, they forged a really close relationship with one another. You know, they were told knit their souls together at that moment. And, you know, what we see, though, with David and Jonathan is that even though they clicked, there was more to their relationship that fueled it and kept it going. And so I want to give you guys four essential ingredients for a successful friendship that come directly from David and Jonathan's friendship. The first is that David and Jonathan's friendship stood on the foundation of sacrificial love. Think about 1 Samuel 18, verse 1. After David had finished talking with Saul, he met Jonathan, the king's son. And there was an immediate bond between them, for Jonathan loved David. And so Jonathan had a deep love for David. They clicked, but there was more to their relationship than simply, you know, chemistry. Or that they somehow were, you know, good together. That the epoxy that held their relationship together was actually sacrificial love. And we see this over and over again in their relationship. Secondly, they committed to maintaining their friendship. In 1 Samuel 18, when they first encounter each other, they actually make a pact before God, a solemn pact, to remain friends and to push each other toward spiritual things. Later on, they actually reaffirm this in chapter 20 and 23. And so there were challenging times in their friendship where they actually had to come back together and reaffirm this pact that they made years earlier. And I think likewise, our lives are going to be tested. And the commitment we have to our friends will be tested. And we're going to have to recommit ourselves not only to friendship in general, but to our friends in particular. You know, trials and life transitions act as a furnace, either refining or consuming our friendships. It's really easy, I think, especially when you're younger, to form friendships and maintain them because you have proximity on your side and free time. But as life gets more and more complicated, it gets harder to maintain those friendships. In a 2014 American Time Youth Study, they found that people between the ages of 20 to 24 years old spent the most amount of time socializing together each day. And that makes sense because, you know, if you're a college-age person, you're living around your friends down on campus, you're pulling all-nighters with them at the library or going and crashing parties down on campus on the weekends. And so you have a lot of time with each other. But it gets more and more difficult as you get a little bit older. The Encyclopedia of Human Relationships states that young adults spend between 10 to 25 hours a week with their friends. That's incredible. And yet, once you move out of college and into your career life, once you get married, once you start throwing in kids into your life, you start to have 1,000 different things clamoring for your attention, and it gets really hard to maintain your friendships. At that point, it's not a matter of trying to just find time for your friends. If you're intent on having deep relationships, you actually have to make time. It has to be a priority. Otherwise, there's going to be this drift. The other thing that's interesting is that when you're younger, your friendship network is actually denser. In other words, your friends are easily accessible because they live close by. But as you get older, that starts to change. According to Andrew Ledbetter in his longitudinal study called Forecasting Friends Forever, he followed pairs of best friends for 19 years, and he noticed that the participants of this study moved an average of 5.8 times since leaving college. And you might be thinking, well, they could have moved, you know, within the outer belt or something like that. They also found that by the 19th year, very few friendship dyads lived within 50 miles of each other with an average distance of 895 miles. In other words, once people graduate from college, there's a tendency to just move out to different parts of the country. And that's because people are chasing after career, they're chasing after job opportunities, they're chasing after money. And that's why I think it's really important for us to prioritize the things of God. To prioritize, first of all, walking with God, secondly, our family, and thirdly, our friends. Because if we don't make those priorities, then we're going to find ourselves growing increasingly isolated. Thirdly, David and Jonathan gave of themselves in every area to each other. We see that when Jonathan first meets David, he gives David his cloak, his sword, his bow, his tunic, all of the things that would eventually get him ready to ascend Israel's throne as the king. And so he sacrificed his material possessions. He also risked his life for David, finding him in the middle of the wilderness and warning him that his father is going to kill David. And they also shared a rich emotional life with one another. Think about one of their last meetings in 1 Samuel 20, verse 41. This is right before David goes on the run and ends up becoming a fugitive in Philistine, a refugee there for a number of years. And David and Jonathan knew that they weren't going to really see each other for a few years. And so this was their parting goodbye. We're told in 1 Samuel 20, verse 41, that both of them were in tears as they embraced each other and said goodbye, especially David. You think about that, you know, two grown men crying and embracing each other. Most guys in our culture would, if they saw two guys doing that in public, they would feel like, that's kind of weird. It's kind of awkward. I think men today are increasingly emotionally vacant, where there is this sort of blockage that prevents us from wanting to share close our emotions with our close friends, especially our friends of the same sex, because we feel like it's really weird and taboo. Niobe Way, a professor of applied psychology at NYU, did a study of boys in high school and tracked how they viewed their friendship entering into high school and as they are exiting. And she had some interesting case studies. Here's one from a boy named Justin. He says, my best friend and I, we love each other. That's it. You have this thing. It's so deep. It's within you. You can't even explain it. I guess in life, sometimes two people can really, really understand each other and really have a trust and respect and love for each other. Well, by his senior year, we're told, he tells us, my friend and I, we mostly just joke around. It's not like really anything serious or whatever. I don't talk to nobody about serious stuff. I just don't talk to anybody. I don't share my feelings, and it's just something that I don't do. And so she tries to understand what happens from freshman year to their senior year, and she believes that it's during those formative years, around 15 and 16 years old, that most boys start to learn what it is to relate as a man. And in our culture, you're not allowed to express your emotions. You're not allowed to express how you feel toward, your guy friend. And so, as men, we're going to face the challenge of having to break out of the mold that our culture wants to put us in and to forge a new way of relating to our other guy friends. Finally, David and Jonathan did what was best for each other in their friendship. We see this when Jonathan encourages David as he's feeling lost and despairing as he's on the run. But David, in another case, actually challenges Jonathan to see that his father has murderous intent, even though Jonathan refused to see it at the time. He had to see it for himself. And it must have been a painful realization, but I'm certain that Jonathan was happy that David did that. You know, their friendship really exemplifies the kind of love that you should see in a spiritual friendship. I want to give you guys a working definition of love. that these guys shared, really incorporating all the components that we see, the four components or ingredients of a successful friendship. Biblical love you could define as a commitment to give of yourself in every area for the good of another. Now, you know, death caused a temporary disruption to David and Jonathan's friendship. Jonathan tried to walk the narrow path of loyalty between his father and David and managed to maintain his loyalty to both. And David loved him so much that when he found out that Jonathan died in battle, he composed this funeral song for him. In 2 Samuel 1, verse 25 and 26, "Oh, how the mighty heroes have fallen in battle. Jonathan lies dead on the hills. How I weep for you, my brother Jonathan. How much I loved you. And your love for me was deep, deeper than the love of a woman." If only we could have the kind of relationship that David and Jonathan had, the kind of friendship that they exemplified. You know, Christ gives us the promise that we will have lasting friendships, friendships that will go on into eternity. I just wanted to give you kind of a, you know, last story here to end our time. You know, each year for, I don't know, almost 20 years now, we have an annual vacation that the college group goes on. And for as many years as I can remember, we would go to this really awesome spot called Holden Beach. I remember when I first went there, there was like maybe 200 people. But by the last time that we went, there was, I don't know, over 1,000 people. It was amazing. But without fail, you know, the guys who drive all night and arrive, you know, in the afternoon, the first thing they do is they burst through the front door and they run through the house and go out to the back deck to overlook the ocean view. And I remember as a brand new Christian hanging out at Holden Beach on the deck, hanging out with my friends, and there was a real striking moment that I experienced there where I felt this sense of contentment. And, you know, moments like that are very fleeting. They disappear quickly. But it occurred to me as I was hanging out with my friends laughing and, you know, the sun was setting and, you know, with this beautiful scenery, all of us, you know, with an adult beverage in our hands. It occurred to me, this is what heaven's going to be like. And this last year, we were unable to go to the beach, but we went to this other place, which was, I think, in some ways just as beautiful, this area in Tennessee around a lake. And I had another striking experience just like that. And it occurred to me, you know, even though heaven is going to be a beautiful place, I don't think we're going to be as excited about that as we are the people that we'll be surrounded with. And so I'd urge you to fight for your friendships because you actually have an opportunity to have a glimpse of what heaven is going to be like as you spend time building deep relationships with your friends. All right. So if you want some further resources on friendship, I've left you some here. Larry Crabb's book, Encouragement, is excellent on this. Gary DeLashmit's book, Loving God's Way, Jeith's book, Reclaiming Friendship. Dennis's book, Organic Discipleship, especially chapter 4, Friendship Building, gives real practical advice on how to build friendship. And I'd also like to add to this, Ken Sandy's book, Peacemaker, too. Turns out, conflict is one of the main killers of friendship, so it's worthwhile to maybe invest some time thinking about that.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.